nothing new under the sun, you know I'm going over. Cause there's nothing left to say. If they said it all here yesterday, if there's nothing new under the sun, I'm going over. Cause there's nothing left to do if I ain't got a chance at something new. Cause maybe this is a test, a chance to prove I've got the stuff.
Welcome again to Invent It Again, the podcast. I am Matt Sagan.
And I'm Christian Slack.
And we're excited to be back. Today we're going to add another definition to our growing but tightly curated list of terms that are really important. As you'll have learned by this point, I'm very much about definitions and terms, because no good debate, no good conversation, and certainly no funding can happen without a very clear understanding of the terms that we're using. Today I want to look at the word investor. We all know what the most common usage of this word is. It's something like, an investor is someone wealthy enough to buy shares in a company in the hopes that the price of the stock will rise so they can sell it then for a profit and or get a dividend payment based on holding on to those stocks. However, this is too limited for the purposes of understanding innovation, because in reality, you become an investor the moment an idea occurs to you. You are deciding to invest the limited hours of your life to pursue this idea. Investment is often described as gambling, but for the most successful of investors, it is only gambling in the way that a casino gambles. In the long run, they win it all back and then some, because they get to set the odds. But whether your idea is to start a casino, and please don't, or if it's something else, there is always risk, so you have to really be a savvy investor. Maybe you're all of a country's taxpayers collectively giving money in the form of a tax rebate to a hot new startup and hoping that that business generates a return in the form of new jobs and more taxes paid. Maybe you're an organization giving money to a person championing a worthy cause and hoping that champion generates a return on your investment in the form of social impact, direct quality of life type stuff like feeding homeless people. Maybe you're an auntie, or a mate giving time or money in the hope that they will generate a return in the form of a share in the profits or the avoidance of future handouts to the one that was asking. In all these cases, an investor always wants a return in some form or another, and to pick good investments, they have to be savvy, right? But what does it mean to be savvy? What principles does a successful investor follow? We've already laid out the principle, don't trust your gut, which implies that we have to use our brains. But how exactly? Today, we'll take a look at a couple of the most successful investors in history, Berkshire Hathaway's legendary Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, who never trust their guts. Instead, they're 100% honest with themselves about what they know and what they don't. And they maintain a clear border around this knowledge with what they call the circle of competence. Inside that circle is not just things they're familiar with. For example, just because Warren drinks 5 Cokes a day doesn't mean he considers the beverage industry as being within his circle of competence. It only contains those areas within which his knowledge confers him an advantage over his competitors. So, Christian, this notion of advantage over competitors, who is Warren Buffett competing with when he invests?
Well, before I answer that, I'll tell you that he's not competing with other investors. So, to illustrate that, he doesn't follow other people. He doesn't follow other people's information, and he doesn't follow other people's actions. And he tries to keep outside any bubbles, because a bubble is essentially something that he's not totally understanding of. So, like any of us who invest, he's only really competing with his own shortcomings. And so he knows where his boundaries are, he knows what he knows, and he's basically sticking to the what he knows rather than what he doesn't know. And that's the description, that's the overall view of the circle of competence.
So, but in addition to the circle of competence and operating outside of it, there are other shortcomings, and these are the principles that we've tried to outline some of the principles, and we'll continue to keep hammering those home, that help us overcome other aspects of our human nature. And I guess in this case, when you talk about not following trends, a big part of that is just patience. I mean, he must have developed a lot of patience. But before we get into those, how does he overcome the shortcomings? How does Warren Buffett and how does Charlie Munger, how do they both overcome? God damn it. How do Warren and Charlie overcome their shortcomings?
In very basic terms, Matt, Warren and Charlie have a process, and they've had that process for a long time. And not only do they have a process, but they stick to it. So they're not being drawn out of that by emotional things. They're not being rushed into doing things, because quite often in the investment space, somebody else has put some money into something, or there's a lot of publicity around something. They're not on the tails of other people going into these investments. So what's really important as well is that, because they won't be rushed, what it means is that they take their time, and they take their time to understand everything that they can that's knowable, there to be known and important about that particular opportunity. And so they're not influenced, if you like, by the fact that the investment's due to finalise in 2 days' time and you better jump in, and somebody else has put money in and he's had great insight in the past, so we can follow that. So they actually do all their own research and their rigour themselves.
And that rush, that not being rushed, it's not always necessarily just a tactic. I mean, having been a co-founder and having needed funding, there are some very real pressures on us to bring money into a company. So it's not always just a tactic. It is a natural result of needing funding.
That's completely right. And the issue there is, if you're looking to entice investors in, you put out a document, typically called an information memorandum, that describes the opportunity from your perspective, and it's generally very succinct, and that ultimately is what the investor uses to make their judgment. Larger acquisitions and the like, technology acquisitions, then people do what they call due diligence, and that takes a lot longer, and they dig around and these sorts of things. So effectively what Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger, Berkshire Hathaway are doing is that they're undertaking some pretty in-depth due diligence on their own terms, using their own criteria, before they make those things. So that's why it's taking them a lot longer to do that. And what it also means is that, because they're not rushed, it means that they can take their time, and if the opportunity isn't there as they see it or according to their process, they won't invest. And that's a really important thing, is that they stick to their process.
They don't subscribe to the scarcity mentality. You know, being inactive is better than being dumb.
Yes, I think they're fairly well published on the fact that they don't see investment as an activity, so they don't need to invest in everything that comes your way, and it's best to sit back and choose your fight. They mentioned that you know, you never get into a conflict or a fight with somebody who's got more aptitude than you have in a particular field. And so that means that they stick to their circle of competence, they know where the boundary is, and they don't step outside it no matter what.
Whew, that's a big one. Off to the countdown. And of course, behind all this is the why we need to overcome these aspects of our human nature, why we need to stay out of our circle of stay in our circle of competence and not stray outside of it. And that's because one of our principles is we need to be frugal. We have a limited amount of time and talent, and we have to be very smart about how we allocate it.
I think that's right. And from our perspective, one of the things that we always try and say is that it's really important that you should be spending as little as you can to get your product, idea, process into the market, because by spending as little resource as you can, you're spending as little money, and you're spending as little time, and it means you can get into the market and start making money. Something that's taken 20 years to get into the market, it's going to be an awful lot of investment burden, i.e. investment that's gone over the pre-market pre-revenue stage to recover. And so the bigger that is, the harder it becomes. Plus the fact you're tying up people's lives in a project for a long, long period of time, and the longer it goes on, for the bigger the risk of it failing and going under.
And now, this is where there's damage done to a nation, you know, especially a small island nation as we live in, where we only have so many experts, we only have so many people on the ground that can deliver particular services due to particular kinds of science and engineering and development, and so these projects if that's an invention again, if somebody's just doing something that's already been done that we could have done for free or incredibly cheaply, incredibly quickly, we're hurting ourselves collectively.
That's absolutely right, Matt. The reality is that if you've got the majority of your productive, potentially productive workforce, and these are very bright people, this has nothing to do with how bright people are, how high their qualifications are or anything else, but if you've got a lot of bright people tied up in projects and development of products and services that are never going to recover the costs of the development, then that's going to impact on the nation's economy significantly.
So I always love to bring things back to the principles. Ultimately, we're trying to make a bit of a cultural shift, a change in the way that all of us see the world, the way that we generate ideas and the way that we pursue them, the way that we allocate our precious hours of our lives and dollars. And if I had to choose one word that brings this concept down, the circle of competence down to what you do and don't do, it's about the humility to really be honest about where the edge of your own circle is, you know, the edge of your own competency, as Charlie Munger put it. He says, Warren and I have skills that could be easily taught to other people. One of those skills is knowing the edge of your own competency.
Interesting point there, Matt, is that it's very easily taught, it's very easily communicated. But whether people take that on board is another matter.
Which gives us another word, which would be discipline, right? I mean,
yes.
It's not hard to learn. It's just like some of those habits, like not biting your nails or any habit that it's easy to say, don't do it. It's easy for you to say, I'm not going to do that again. But to have the discipline is different.
Definitely. And it comes back to your gambling analogy as well. There's definitely a thrill of a chase and a thrill of an unknown and a punt, if you like. And this is all about putting those things to one side and making very deliberate and informed decisions rather than gut feel.
To reinforce that idea that this is a skill easily taught to other people, here's another quote. Staying within a circle of competence is obviously not rocket science, but it is hard to do when you meet a slick promoter who is highly skilled at telling stories. Now, the habit to develop here, like we said before, is discipline. Doing nothing is a very hard thing for most people to do, even when it's the most appropriate course of action. People, for some reason, think that there's a bonus for you if you just keep active in investing and keep doing things and are seen to be doing things, when in fact, it's almost certainly not. What do you think about that?
Completely agree, Matt. It's like the, I don't know what you call them, pokies or fruit machines and things like that. It's so easy to keep feeding the machine because you think that that's what you do rather than sitting back and actually thinking about the odds and the consequences and the likelihoods of doing what you're doing. And in investment as well, it's an interesting thing is that in New Zealand and elsewhere, there are groups of investors who have come together because they have the money. And it's well thought that those investors are qualified or investors that are able to make decisions on their own bat. And it's generally a result of them having money and having enough money that even if things don't work out, then they're prepared to lose it. And I think that's probably creates a mindset which is unhelpful.
Mm. There was this slogan, and I don't recall if it was from my childhood in the States or if this was something from New Zealand's marketing campaign for buying scratcher tickets, which I don't do anymore. You got to be in it to win it.
Yep.
Now, that's it seems to describe the mindset that you're talking about, but there's probably, it's half of the appropriate quote, which would be, you got to be in it to win it, but chances are you're not going to win it. So in fact, being in it is only ever going to be a cost in the long run.
That's right. And you find that there are investment groups, and I won't mention any names, but it's a well-established philosophy that investment in early stage businesses, so these are things that have gone past the idea stage into telling the story, if you like, and going out to raise capital, that typically, investment groups are looking at investing in 10 opportunities, we'll call them, and typically one might be a success, maybe one or two others break even, or they don't lose money, and the rest fall by the wayside. But like a lot of things, it's really difficult to find out, and it's really difficult to find information around the things that don't succeed. And we're very driven by the things that have succeeded in the past. And this is where also the role of personality, the cult of personality, if you like, takes over, because there can be relatively few investors and relatively few entrepreneurs, so that people go around and around the traps all the time. So there are people with different new ideas and different new businesses.
Which is what our mission is trying to fix, right?
Exactly.
There is no scarcity of ideas. Which means there's no scarcity of entrepreneurs for us to tap from. Yep. It's just that we're talking sometimes to the wrong people.
Definitely. So having this sort of seen, it's a bit like patents as well, being seen to need a patent to go forward. You might
to legitimize it.
Yeah, and you might need to find a celebrity entrepreneur or a celebrity investor to take part in what you're doing, and that will magnetically attract a whole lot of other people to take part in it as well.
I'm guilty of having used this expression, and I know I admitted it to you. It's almost like a confessional. As soon as so-and-so jumps in the pool, everybody else is going to jump in the pool. Yep. And it's a really cynical and wrong thing to say, and I'm ashamed for ever having thought that.
And it moves it even further away than the individual's gut feel, because you're relying on somebody else's gut feel.
As if your own gut wasn't bad enough, you're going to trust someone else's.
That's it.
There are several ways to expand the borders of your circle of competence, but there's some ways that are a lot more comfortable than others. One way is to go out there and make mistakes, and it's part of our principles that we're boiling down out of all this stuff, to celebrate failure, you know, to get out there, to try things, stub your toe, get hurt, fall down, get up again. That will develop a lot of grit and a lot of the strength that you're going to need as an entrepreneur to be able to get things going, or whether it's a social entrepreneur or you're trying to get a business going that generates profit, you will need that strength. However, the far more comfortable way is by reading, endless reading. And that's what Warren Buffett does all the time, isn't it?
It is. And again, there's no secret to reading. I think in the movie as Big Short as well, there was a part in that where he just says, how do you know this information? I just read. And that's exactly what we're talking about. The problem is that people, if they're making mistakes because they're operating outside their circle of competence, they don't necessarily realize that that's the reason that they made the mistake.
So the learnings are actually the wrong learnings. They may not be expanding the borders at all.
That's right.
Just stumbling in the dark.
Yes. Yeah. And so if they're encouraged to come up with more ideas and spend more on R&D and all of these things, they can write off what they did the last time, but they're going to be destined to repeat that if they don't know why those mistakes were made.
I'm really glad you said that and you called me out on that, because just as we are in this episode talking about the border between your circle of competence and everything that's outside of it, those areas in which you really shouldn't be investing and competing because you just don't have an advantage and therefore it's just not worth the risk. There's this other border that's quite important between real R&D, real development, innovation, the things that are going to drive us forward as a species and develop more solutions to problems. And on the other side of that, educational things that should really have their own earmarked funding. They already do. It's just that we're not clear enough about the terms and it gets blurry. And that's where a lot of waste occurs is we do end up spending, we call it R&D investment. We sponsor events where we try to cram this stuff into a weekend or into a particular period instead of doing it as an ongoing habitual thing. And those are really, they're education. The budgets under which those things are run should be educational budgets, not R&D budgets. And I'm really glad you brought that up.
That's right, Matt. And I think the other thing that's really important to remember, and we've talked about novelty a lot and how it's important for invention and how it's important to registering intellectual property and those sorts of things. Actually, the definition of R&D given by the OECD, one of their manuals, which is utilized in a lot of countries around the world, is, and this is a summary of it, is the generation of new knowledge which adds to the global stock of knowledge. So if you're in a position where your R&D isn't new, you're not creating new knowledge, and therefore you're not adding to the global stock of knowledge. So you are reissuing and
inventing again.
Absolutely, this is our thing. Undertaking R&D, which is an activity, to not generate new knowledge. So that knowledge is available somewhere in the public domain. And so rather than you spending years and years developing this independently, you can open a book or you can consult the internet or search through various information sources, and you can find that information probably within a very short period of time.
Which we try to prove time and again with IPSnap.
That's right.
And we'll do a couple of those later on the episode.
And just as another statistic to throw into there, and I know you've heard it quite a lot, Matt, but in the 1990s, some work was done in Europe around the novelty of R&D. So they looked at all, the EC at the time looked at all the investments they were making in their innovation projects, and that was across the board from academia and from industry and sort of joint efforts from different organisations. And they estimated from looking at a very basic look at novelty that 20 billion euros a year were wasted on duplicating R&D, so this is not generating new knowledge, in the EU. And so I don't suspect that New Zealand's any different to that, and I don't suspect anywhere else in the world is different to that. It's a very common thing that even people who are very bright don't necessarily know what somebody did in the past or in another country or a different market or a different application.
Especially, the smarter you are, the more dangerous this is. We will have an episode about the Dunning-Kruger effect, which some of you may be familiar with, of overestimating one's own intelligence.
Yeah. This all comes back to the stock of knowledge and the circle of competence, is that these people's circle of competence is limited by their own stock of knowledge. And so as soon as they're looking at something which they think is new, they're going to get on, look for funding for that and look to develop that and spend time doing it. Not going to ask themselves necessarily, am I going to look to prove that what my new idea is based on what I know is not new.
It just doesn't occur to them. And that's really part of our mission here. So we want this to be a baseline part of the thinking for each of us when we look out into the world to find problems. Now, just coming back to the more comfortable way to expand one's circle of competence. There's a great quote here from another one of these articles. Charlie Munger said, "You don't have to pee on an electric fence to learn not to do it." At the most recent Berkshire meeting, he quipped, "Learning from other people's mistakes is much more pleasant, and the best way to do this is simple. When in doubt, read so you can learn vicariously."
Completely agree with that. There is an awful lot to be gained by reading. And again, we talked about lookers last time and what the characteristics are of somebody who goes out there and gathers information and can structure it in a way that makes sense to them. And obviously Charlie Munger's got a very good personal way of doing that. Like I said before, they're not relying on other people to assemble that information. They're going out there and they're looking for it themselves, and they're doing a lot of reading. And each time they read something, they're adding that to their circle of competence.
You guys will probably get sick of me saying this, but we're always trying to tie this back to the principles that should guide a looker. And really, if the only thing comes out of this show is that for you dedicated listeners that tune in and try to take on these principles, that they become a part of who you are, and that it helps you protect yourself against waste. It helps you protect your family, your town, your country, and your planet against the waste that is involved in reinventing things over and over again and repeating history. People with ideas often picture themselves as a Dyson or an Edison, and it's really about them and how they're perceived, and the honorific, the kudos, and the fame that comes with this. However, if they were honestly working within their circle of competence, they would protect themselves against this fantasy. They wouldn't construct that fantasy in the first place, and therefore wouldn't be in a position to be so hurt by the fall from that incredible height of that fantasy of height, like Icarus with his wax wings. They would have stayed on the ground until they had a more sensible means of getting themselves off the island.
Yeah, so the interesting thing about those two examples you've given is that both Edison and Dyson, the story is, if you look into the way in which the story of their development is portrayed, kind of relies on a bit of fantasy and a bit of fiction around the fact of where they started from and what exactly it was that they invented. So, for example, with Edison, he didn't invent the electric light bulb, and he wasn't the first person to invent the evacuated glass light bulb and the incandescent filaments and these sorts of things. But he was very good at taking mechanisms and materials and the like and mass producing them and making them reliable and cheaper and more efficient. And that's really where his story comes in. He wasn't the inventor, but that doesn't matter. Again, I mean, we keep saying this again. With Dyson, it's really important, as far as his vacuum cleaner goes, that he didn't invent cyclonic separation. So the principles of a motor-driven cyclone for taking dust out of an airstream has been around for 150 years. And he actually fell over a cyclonic separator when he was in a spray booth. And he used to originally designed a wheelbarrow called a bull barrow that had a powder-coated or a painted frame. And he saw this extractor while he was developing and while he's producing his bull barrows and thought, wouldn't it be good to put one of these things in a vacuum cleaner? And he wasn't actually the first person to put a cyclonic separator in a vacuum cleaner, and that has been done in the 1920s. So he was the first person in terms of that to actually produce a dual cyclone that uses no bag. He didn't spend years and years and years thinking that he was the inventor of cyclonic separation. He leapfrogged, if you like, and got to the point of where he could get to using what was existing and then started to develop his own products. And from there, that grew. And a lot of hard work and a lot of time was involved in getting that product to market. And there's a story there in the fact that he actually developed the technology and licensed it to a Japanese company. And then one of the larger firms copied his invention. He'd had it patented and he was able to sue them for infringement, and he got a lot of money out of that, which he then allowed him to start a production facility in the UK and start making them himself. So all of those things together are there. And the interesting thing with Dyson as well, he's had the ball barrow, he's made washing machines, which were available on the market and no longer available. He's made those hand dryers that you've seen, various other things. I don't know exactly how successful they've been. There are and the heaters and these sorts of things. And he's also invested, I think we mentioned last time, £500 million in an electric vehicle, which he's since ceased to pursue.
Showing that even the best make some pretty big boondoggles.
Absolutely. So you're in that space again where you're saying, well, actually, from the outside, it's okay because he can afford to fail on £500 million worth of investment. But it doesn't make it a better failure, or it doesn't make it a better process that they went through. So again, it's that coming back to that cult of personality. Somebody who's been successful in the past, it doesn't mean that person's next idea is going to be brilliant.
And we will spend an entire episode on that, I think, coming up soon, talking about the idea of the cult of personality and the survivor bias and the ignoring of failures. You know, these are all really important parts of being a good looker and being a good ideator. I know that I can make the mistake of trying to find a moral of a story, and listening to you say that story again about Dyson is a reminder to me that started with him exploiting something that he hadn't come up with himself to generate enough capital to do a bunch of other successful things. So we're all about that. We're all about not having to dilute your company. You know, if you're starting yourself out doing something, not having to take on investment to do a bunch of R&D to reinvent something, sometimes it's best to just start with exploiting something that's already been done so that you actually have the resource. If you are a person that will come up with an idea that is truly novel in some aspect, you'll have the resource to spend on developing that one.
Completely right, Matt. And the other way of looking at that is there is no shame at all. I mean, we talked before about celebrating things, standing on the shoulders of giants that have gone before. If you don't know those giants exist, you're still going to be fumbling about in the undergrowth when you need to be out there making the money. So it's very important that we know what's gone on in the past so that we can use that for advantage and leapfrog into actually implementation and making the differences that they're seeking to make.
Wherever possible, and that's quite often.
Yep.
Okay, next up on IP Snap, we have the portable boxing ring trailer. Now, this was a partial submission. It didn't come from someone who was looking at commercialization. This was, and I think this is a really interesting example and one that I want to do more of. A lot of what we're talking about in this process is not necessarily just for a commercial outcome directly, in terms of making a product, a new product or a new process that can then be produced at scale and sold as a product to someone else, but is also just something for personal passion projects, for things that people want. The global stock of knowledge is contained in the patent record. Designs of some of the greatest minds of all time, recorded, drawn, detailed. blueprints for us to make things that make our lives better, proven ways of doing things. And so I'm really excited to jump into this one, because I'd be gobsmacked if somebody hasn't made a boxing ring that can be moved around. So computer, if you could kick us off a 15-minute countdown timer for this Invented Again IP snap. Here we go. I'm going to hop in and look up some images and see if I can find something that looks about right. Where are you headed, Christian?
Yeah, I'm just going to have a look at the patents, just find some intriguing old technologies if we can. So one of the techniques to use when we're searching for things is to, again, using Google patents here, is to try and look for the older things. As I said before in the discussion we had, the older the patent, the broader and it sits over the top of things. So if you can demonstrate that it's been done a long time ago with an early patent, then generally they tend to be a pretty close match. So we're focused on this. So this has to go on a trailer, does it, man? It's not just a demountable one. It has to have wheels and
as described, it was a trailer, just because I'm guessing, because this person would have been looking at images and looking at other ways that people have approached it. And there are lots of ones that you can break down and put into something else. But if you're presumably, he's a teacher, he just wants to be able to rock up and not have, you know, an hour of setup. He just wants to be able to rock and roll.
Absolutely.
I've used portable boxing ring as my search terms on the image search, and to... in the first several pages, nothing on a trailer. Lots of different configurations of platform. There is that unique aspect of a boxing ring. It's not like assembling another type of stage. It's a suspension. It's suspended from the outer edge so that it has bounce. It's almost like being on a trampoline, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not a boxer, but I'm pretty sure that's how they work. And then the stretched ropes also are only supported at the corners with those padded corners. So, I mean, I'm going to add to my terms trailer and just see if we can narrow this down a little bit.
Yeah, something's popped up here. It's not really old, so it's not crazy, but there's a European patent that I found here for a mobile boxing ring, and that appears to... So this is from the early 90s, so this is a fair age now in terms of the patent that would have expired automatically. My French isn't great, but there's a trailer unit here, and there's so it's got the wheels and the axles, and it's also got a fold-out ring, and I'll show you that now, mate.
Would you paste that link really quick, and then I can just look at it on my Stack Overflow?
Sure. I'll just
as with all things, we're still working out our processes in IP Snap. Yeah, this is just as new to us, this way of doing it. We're not just in the pub with our phones anymore. We've upgraded. Image search is turning up nothing as yet. Okay. Nothing that I see could be towed. But it sounds like you're onto something promising there. Are you even digging in a bit further?
Yeah, I'll just do a bit of a search against the inventor.
Even though I'm not seeing anything that looks like that, I can see from your description, and before you even described it, I could see in my mind something opening up from a trailer. We've seen lots of trailers that have decks that fold out. This there must be. Have you already checked that into our
body? Must be at least one character. You entered zero.
Oh, Stack Overflow has an interesting little validation thing where you need to put some other text besides a link. It doesn't recognize a link pasted in as a character. Okay. Stack Overflow, can you get on that, please? Sometimes we're just posting links as comments. Great piece of software, though. Shout out to Stack Overflow.
Okay.
All right, I'll refresh and have a look at what you found. Okay. Look at this picture. I find these pictures to be so interesting. Looking through patent pictures is peering into the minds of inventors. Okay, yeah, now that folded view, yeah, when you see the folded view. So we're looking at some figures here of a trailer. You can see that the corners are rigid and fold in and then out, and this one even has a little roof, doesn't it? This looks like the roof might stay on, and yep. keep you dry. Although the ring itself does fold beyond that, so you'd have to huddle in the middle. Probably not meant for use in the rain, but I'd say that's a snap.
Yep.
Excellent. Should we have a little closer look at this one? Is there anything that jumps out at you?
It's got all the features that we were looking for, such as the trailer and the expandable element, and obviously the purpose of the boxing ring. There's some English translations of the claims on Google Patents as well, and that's interesting reading. It says trailer convertible into a boxing ring. That's the first part of the claim.
There we go. Yep.
Of the type comprising a chassis surmounted by a body and fitted on rolling means, so wheels. Characterise that the body is equipped with a fixed floor, four vertical frame members, a roof supported by the frame members, and four lateral walls hingedly mounted on the edge of the roof, the lateral walls being able to be locked onto the chassis for transport to be held in outwardly raised position, and that it further comprises two downwardly foldable side panels, and these sort of things. And then it goes on to say various rings, but it says number three of the claims is trailer according to claim two, which is these dependent claims as they're called, characterising that the ropes of the boxing ring are permanently fixed on the angle post. So it's the same purpose, it's fulfilling the same objective.
Yep.
There may well be lots of other ways of
doing
folding
this.
We might get it more compressed, maybe
able to make it smaller, miniaturised.
Absolutely, but in the broad sense, the idea has been covered off.
And a good starting point for maybe a modernization. You said this was back in 1992. And we've got some since then, we've got a lot more access to carbon fiber manufacturing techniques for making things light, making things smaller, that still support the same amount of weight. So again, none of this is about crushing dreams. You can still get out there and make improvements on this, but now at least we know we found a snap, something that solves the problem in the way described. So thank you for that submission. I'd love to see one of these at my kid's school at some point in the near future.
Absolutely.
Not all of us have ideas for solving problems, but every single one of us faces them. I made a little experiment on Facebook, and I said, "What's your problem?" People have asked if they need to have an idea to get involved with Invent It Again, and the answer is no. Even if you've just identified a problem, anything that bothers you, that you know other people face as well, and that you wish someone would solve, you should let us know, because there are probably 100 ways others have solved this problem before, and we want to help you find it. But please don't ask us to solve your personal problems. We won't find you a date, and we won't clean your house, you cheeky buggers. So we got a couple of responses. My cousin, Kari, asked about a cheap sandpaper device that has a vacuum feature so that when you're sanding, it gets sucked up instead of clinging to your hair. Now, that was a pretty quick snap. Some of the hand sanders often have a vacuum built in, but we also got some people contributing, including Richard, who said you can buy a simple or sophisticated dust collector with a bucket with a filter between the sander or the saw or whatever and the vacuum cleaner. And I think then Jason chimed in and said, look up the Dust Deputy, which is a brand of cyclone separator, which is tied to the Dyson conversation we've had. Very simple solutions for this problem. So that was really cool to see that. And then Doug chimed in about GPS tracking. And in the same way we can make it easier to get you involved with Invent It Again by just asking you about problems, Christian has another idea about how you might be able to get involved. You want to share that with us, Christian?
Yeah, sure. So what we're really looking for, and we've done a few of what we call historical snaps. So these are things that have happened in the past, and where we've sort of, with the benefit of hindsight, and a lot of hindsight, and also some information that predated these ideas, we've sort of looked at the basis and the validity and some of the knowledge and some of the circle of competence around the development of those things. So What's really interesting to a lot of people is really the origins of these ideas. So if there's anything in particular that you're thinking about, you know, maybe it's an article in the news, you've seen somebody come up with this new idea, or maybe an object that you've got at home, you know, that you can look at. I remember a wee while ago looking at a powerless espresso maker and finding that there's some quite beautifully designed ones that were developed in the 1950s in Italy. And, you know, they're available on eBay and all this sort of thing. So if there's something out there that you think, oh, I just wonder where that came from, or the background of this, and whether it's this new idea that people are putting out there is truly new, then it'd be really useful to get you to send in those observations and those products so that we can have a quick look and just try and establish that chain of thought and the decisions and the process that people have gone through to get there.
And in the same way, it may not have to be in your house now. You may remember something from some decades ago that did a job so perfectly well, and the ones that you're finding at the shop now are just crap. They just don't do it anywhere near as well. And the example that I can think of right now is this grater that we had when I was a kid. I think I've described this to you, where one of the legs of the tripod was the handle that you held that also doubled as the armature, the bit that you would squeeze to put pressure on whatever it was in the rotary grater portion. And it was just so easy to use. Even as a child, I could grate really tough stuff without my knuckles ever coming anywhere near the grater. And yeah, so if you have a fond memory of something that was really good that you haven't seen in a while, let's hear about that too.
Sounds great. Thanks, Matt.
I've got an idea, Christian.
Really, Matt?
Well, actually, it's yours. I just borrowed it, but that's good, right?
It is. Any idea is good.
I'm just elaborating on Christian's idea about getting you to look out there and to follow your gut and to see if there's something on Kickstarter. I'm going to send you over to a website that you may or may not know about called Kickstarter.com. There's another one called Indiegogo. Any crowdfunded site will do, where people are putting up their products or their prototypes or even the drawings of the promise of what it might be. And follow your gut. Find the coolest thing, the thing where your gut says, This is a really great idea. I think I should get one of those. Send it through to us as a link to that thing on whichever website you find, and we'll test your gut. We'll see how good your gut feel was in regards to how novel this thing is.
Perfect.
Now we're going to do another historic IP snap, which is more like, was it new at a certain point in time? We're going to look back at an invention that is an iconic New Zealand invention, loudly proclaimed as a big move forward in its particular field, and I'll let Christian describe this one.
Okay, thanks, Matt. What we're talking about today is something called a spring-free trampoline. Now, most of you have seen those, I'm sure. The key aspect of the spring-free trampoline is that it uses bendable rods that you insert between a framework and a trampoline mat, and the rods twist and bend as you're jumping up and down on the mat. And that's what resists the motion. So in some ways, spring free is an interesting way of putting it, because they are springs, they just operate in a different way. As an engineer might call them leaf springs or torsion bars, depending on which way they're operating. So it's maybe a bit of a misnomer to call it spring free. It certainly doesn't use coil springs in the way that a traditional trampoline does.
Which reminds me that with any of these ideas, we request that the people who are submitting them, we're obviously submitting this ourselves to do a bit of a historical snap, but you always have to talk about the problem. And anybody who's been on a trampoline of the old variety that had springs, they're dangerous things, aren't they? The frame, the level of the sheet on which you're jumping is the same as a very, very hard metal frame.
Yep.
And the springs themselves are made of metal, and often the foam pad that protects you from that metal deteriorates much quicker than the metal, often, always.
Yes.
That thing is usually gone at some point, and broken arms and broken foreheads ensue.
Yes, and legs through springs and all the other problems that are associated with that. So the background to this is that the exactly where Matt's coming from, it was a problem, and there's a chap called Keith Alexander, who's a professor at Canterbury University. He came up with the idea. His wife said, we're not getting a trampoline for our daughter. I've done some research in America. There's thousands and thousands of injuries registered every year from trampolines, and I don't think it's appropriate. And so he went off and he designed a model. So there's quite a few videos around on the internet. If you Google spring free inventor, there's videos available on the spring free website, and there's also other videos as well. And he talks about the process that he went through. So he started with the problem safety, and he developed this system for using these rods and springs to support the base of the trampoline. And you've seen some of them around, some of them are sort of an oval shape and the like. So he went forward with this, I think. The
By the base, you actually mean what I referred to as the sheet, right? The base, to me, would be the legs, the way that it connects to the ground.
Yes.
And you're saying that the springs are, you know, that these other armatures that are still acting like springs, yeah, but they're calling them spring-free, yeah, units, are beneath the sheet upon which you bounce, the canvas.
That's right. So there's
okay,
a,
just making sure that
there's a fixed support frame, and attached to the fixed support frame is a number of these rods, and supported on the other end of the elements above the level of the fixed frame is the flexible sheet that you bounce on.
Gotcha.
So you're moving, if you like, the hard frame, which causes some of those accidents, away from the jumping surface.
Gotcha.
Or the operational surface. And you're doing away with the holes between the two of them. So with a traditional trampoline, you have a flexible sheet that you bounce on is of a smaller diameter than the outer frame, and the sheet is suspended by each of those coil springs to the edges, so that they're on both on the same level. So it's all right. Well, it actually works as some similar principles here historically to the way that conveyors and conveyor belts are sprung using leaf springs from a fixed support. So you get a little wobbling and vibrating tables and this sort of thing, and they tend to use leaf springs. These leaf springs also, and they can be single leaf, so they can just be a bar. They've also been used in seat suspension and all sorts of other things as well. So there's, you know, bicycle seats and seats for offshore power boats and these sorts of things. So there's a lot of mechanical principles here. So what happened was, he developed the concept. A company was formed in Christchurch. They got investment from offshore. They registered the patent, which I've got in front of me here. So that was the priority date was November the 2nd, 1999. So patents last for 20 years, then this date in the US, it's likely to expire either in November of last year or it could be October of this year, depending on which date they go with. So it's coming up to the end of its period. What's interesting here is that the patent only references, when you look at the front of a patent in the States, you're obliged to tell the patent office what you know, which is one key thing. The second thing is that the patents that are put on the front, they're required to be put in as a list. So you have patents that are provided by the inventor, and then there's also some patents which are found by the examiner during the examination process. And in this one here, what's really interesting is that the amount of prior art that the applicant and the examiner was aware of, and indeed the extent of the material that was used in the examination, is very, very small.
Which should be a red flag. You ask somebody what are the other ways in which this thing has been solved. If they say nothing or one thing or two things, and it's this type of thing that's been around some time, that's a red flag.
It is. And from the inventor's perspective, the fact that the examiner's only found two patents, they might present that as this is totally new and completely different, and therefore is a better opportunity.
Misusing it as a sales technique.
Yes, because of their limited knowledge, again. And so it's an interesting sort of paradox with that. And as a result, the patent's quite broadly written. So I'll just read the claim. I think most people, if you look up spring-free trampolines, Google that, you'll find out what the product looks like if you don't already know what it looks like. And so what it claims is a trampoline, so it's assuming that you know what a trampoline is, comprising a flexible mat with a plurality of first retaining means located around the mat perimeter. And what that means is it's got a flexible mat on the top, and it's got all these slots into which these poles and springs go. And it says a plurality of second retaining means located about the periphery of a support element. So this is the frame that goes underneath, and it's got, again, got the holes in the poles. And a plurality of flexible elongated rods. And you could say that any bar made of a material that's flexible is a flexible elongated rod. And there's more than one of them. So there's a plurality, which is a quite common patent language. Such that in use on a flat horizontal surface, the mat forms a horizontal plane. So it's a level thing, you don't roll off the edge. Having an upper contact surface, so that's the surface you bounce on, and a lower non-contact surface, so that's the underside of the mat, orientated vertically above the support element. So it sits above the frame, which is what we talked about. Wherein each said flexible rod is retained at the first and second end by said first and second retaining means respectively. So it means that you slot the rod into the top and the bottom part. It doesn't say that they're on a particular angle at this point in time or anything. So it's a very broad claim. So it's basically saying, look, you've got this mat that sits above the frame, and the two are connected by multiple
flexible
rods. Yeah. So What's interesting with this is that there has been, and it's publicized again, if you Google the spring-free trampoline and patents and whatever, you'll find that there has been some litigation. So the spring-free's been through some litigation, I think, with some manufacturer in China. I believe that they manufacture in China, and there were some people copying what they were doing in China. So they've been through that, and the belief is that this patent is really strong, and they showed the copying party the door, and they were successful, and this was all because of this amazingly strong patent. What's also come about is that there's been a couple of competitors that have tried to do things in slightly different ways, and one of these competitors is a company called VooLeap, which I think you can buy their product through Torpedo 7 and a few other suppliers. So they're an Australian-based company, but I think they have operations in New Zealand. And they've developed a trampoline which uses leaf springs as well. So they're flexible matters above that. And what's interesting here is that they've cited the spring-free patent, but they've also gone back and they've cited a whole lot of stuff from the 1890s and 1900, which relate principally to mats for people jumping from tall buildings. So they're sort of a safety net, a bit like from a trapeze artist. And that what that does is, as a looker, it opens up the door to say, actually, there's a whole lot of stuff that's similar to a trampoline that people did a long time ago, which they used for other means.
And importantly, didn't refer to as a trampoline.
That's right,
which,
yes.
Which comes a lot to the semantics and the words and the jargon that is used in various periods, at various places, and in various applications.
That's right. So if you look at a trampoline, or Google trampolines or history of trampolines, you'll find that looks to be developed in the 1930s, I think. So this is all things that happened before the invention of the trampoline for exercise and sport and things like that. So what's interesting with their claim in their patent is it's a trampoline comprising a frame. So again, it's got a frame. A jumping mat supported above the frame. So that's the same as the spring free. The jumping mat having an outer perimeter. So it's the flexible mat having a perimeter. It says wherein the outer perimeter of the jumping mat is a different size than the outer perimeter of the frame. So they're differentiating it from the spring free by saying, well, actually the mat is a different diameter than the outside of the frame. Again, it says a plurality of spaced apart flexible and resilient plates connected to and extending upwardly from the frame to support the jumping mat above the frame, wherein all of the plurality of plates connect to the jumping mat at an outer perimeter of the jumping mat, and a safety net extending upwardly from the outer perimeter of the jumping mat. So they added the safety net in, and they're talking about a plurality of plates as opposed to a plurality of rods. But anyway, a square section rod is probably a plate.
Yeah.
So the key thing here that they I haven't gone into it in massive detail, but the differentiation would be the fact the mat is a different diameter to the base, whereas the spring free one is pretty much the same. The perimeter follows the perimeter of the frame underneath. So I had a look at these things. I had a look at the old things that they'd done, and it's really good that they put those older patents in there. The older patents tend to be a lot simpler to read and a lot more to the point and a lot broader in scope. And what we also did, I did some independent search using some of the terms, because obviously the terms for jumping from tall buildings onto things are not the same. And one of the things we came up with is a patent called a fire escape. That's its title. And that was patented in October the 23rd, 1883. So it's getting on a bit in years. And what it is, it says that, be it known, here we go, that I, Ira Buckham of Brooklyn, County of Kings and State of New York, have invented new and useful improvements in fire escapes. And I do hereby declare that the following is a full and exact description of the same, reference being had to the accompanying drawings and to the letters of reference marked thereon. So it's saying I've got some pictures here and I've got some things marked on there. And it goes on to say, this invention relates to that class of fire escapes, so it's admitting that these things exist, which are provided with elastic or yielding surfaces for receiving persons jumping or falling from burning buildings. And it consists mainly first in the combination with a truck, having pivoted axles at each end, of a framework supporting an elastic or yielding surface, and a second in the combination with an elastic surface of certain air cylinders adapted to prevent rebound. So their purpose is to, obviously, not to fire people back up once they drop into the thing. So they've got these pneumatic or
shock absorbers
effectively, yeah, under the mat. And it goes on to talk about a few of the other things. In the picture, it quite clearly shows the trailer unit, the framework, and the mat suspended above the truck unit and the framework. And the patent number, just in case anyone wants to look, is 287228. That's US 287228. If you go to Google Patents and you type in 287228, you should be able to find it. So it goes on and it talks about a few other things, and it says C, letter C, represent leaf springs, each of which is provided with a right angle base. So it's not necessarily a flat piece, by means of which a proper clip from the spring is strongly secured to the end of the crossbeam of the frame. So effectively, it's got a set of leaf springs that are attached to the frame and they're attached to the flexible mat.
Sounds familiar.
Yes. And it's certainly a chunk of what Spring Free are claiming, and it's a significant chunk of what Vuli are claiming as well. So, you know, looking at the Vuli thing, it's quite interesting because they've obviously known that there's a whole lot of things here.
They haven't referenced this.
So this patent here is not cited by anybody. So you won't find it by finding something, a trampoline, and then finding a citation or finding anything else and looking for a citation. It's an independent find through using terminology and also using classification. So that's another a way of looking. So each of the patents is classified into a particular way.
Or misclassified, as in my personal experience.
That's right.
Great pain.
So again, it will make reference to this, that one of the best ways of understanding novelty is to find the earliest thing that you can. So, you know, 1883 is pretty good. There may well be some older stuff, who knows, but the people in 1883 are saying this belongs to the class of fire escapes that we're talking about. So what's really interesting here is that really the novelty is it does look different. It's not a picture snap, but in terms of the functionality, in terms of the process, in terms of the invention, i.e. how it works, pretty much all in there from 1883.
Sometimes when we're listening to these things spoken aloud rather than looking at the pictures as we are here in a podcast, the language is the same, and it really does draw attention to that difference, that design differences and aesthetic differences don't infer novelty.
Completely, yes. Yeah. So if you call something a pole or a rod,
it's or a plate,
yes,
or a shock,
it's not. And also, really, if you're making it out of different materials, you could say, oh well, the spring free trampoline is made out of a composite spring, but it doesn't make any difference because the functionality, it's a functional equivalent, as people call it, to using something else.
So, for example, when the first person to make a carbon fiber type construction, they wouldn't then go to every single patent ever made and then propose that they had invented a carbon fiber version of each of those things. That would be ludicrous.
Yes.
That's why patents are sort of above the consideration of just the material. It's about the configuration, the function.
That's right. And the way that typically, if an examiner knew about this, then they'd say, well, this is a functional equivalent, or it's a simple design choice to use this material over something else, and this is widely known. So if it's widely known, it means that you can combine that knowledge with the design from the 1800s.
And this is a good limitation. It's a good guideline, because otherwise we would have way too many patents to wade through if they had to go to that level of differentiation.
Yes.
That's the purpose of that requirement, right?
And it's also about the three requirements when a patent's granted. The first is it's new, it's novel. And the second is there an inventive step? And the other way of saying inventive step is to say, is it obvious? Given the knowledge of two bits of disclosures, so one could be about carbon fiber, the other could be about the fire escape, is it obvious to somebody who knows these things to combine those two things together?
So in this historic snap, we're not having a go at this person. We're simply trying to show that even for them, had they found this particular patent, they would have gone faster. They would have been protecting their daughter sooner.
Yep.
And that the patent that they lodged could have been more brief. It could have just said, here's the old state of this is how it was. We've made this modification, and they may or may not have been granted that patent. But instead, that R&D time has been spent, the money has been spent, the patent has been granted. There's even been litigation. Somebody else has been not allowed to do something only because they didn't have the rocks that you've found that would have blunted those scissors and stop them from getting pushed out of the market.
Exactly
right. So in fact, that was wrong that happened.
Absolutely. And the thing that is also worth considering is that if you were to look at that product now and you thought, I could copy that or I could use that, if you could demonstrate that the patent isn't new and you base your invention wholly on the older material, then in reality, you can't infringe their patent because you're using expired prior art, which is set free for anybody to use after 20 years.
That company that got pushed out and litigated out of that market wished they had hired you.
Yes. And for the sake of a few minutes, they could have found that.
I'd say that looks like a snap.
It certainly is.
We have an anonymous submission today. Obviously, somebody who's a bit of a bicycle enthusiast who is not really impressed with the current state of the art when it comes to adhesive patches. The problem is that adhesive patches stink because they rely on stopping pressure outside of the tube, where it's a fight. Whereas on the inside of the tube, the pressure is assisting in holding it tight. So if a plastic rivet were to have a radius even slightly bigger than the hole when deployed, then it should do a better job. Because it's plastic, we should be able to deploy the rivet without a gun by pulling a cord that then disconnects and is discarded, or a simple reusable one. Now, normally I wouldn't put this on the show because they didn't talk too much about whose problem it is and really define the advantages of this over the competition in terms of is it worth solving? Is it such a cheap problem that there's nothing to improve upon? But I thought this was an interesting one just because I would love to have this. My gut is telling me that I would love to have this and that it might be something that is novel, at least in this application. So, computer, if you would please kick us off a 15-minute timer while we play IP Snap on plastic rivets for patching tires. And take it away, Christian.
Excellent.
I'll look with you this time.
Excellent. That sounds good, Matt. It's a problem that a lot of people have got, of course, which is great. And
what's your search? Just back up. What's your what was your first search term?
So the search term, I'm just looking in the general Google search, and put in a tube rivet tool.
Okay.
So we're looking not only at the rivet itself, but we're looking at the way of
applying. Now, just to clarify and to repeat. I think that the idea here is that it doesn't require a separate tool, that the tool is integral to the rivet itself. So there's some sort of a pull cord which generates the outward and simultaneous inward force. So there must be some sort of a self-collapsing...
Yep.
I'm not very good at describing this because I'm not a product engineer, but you'll have great terms for this when you search. But yep. Just so that we... Maybe I'll do one without tool, and you carry on down that track,
okay.
And I'll look for inner tube rivet. I do have to agree that this is a problem worth solving. I've had, especially over the lockdown when we couldn't get to the shops and get a new tube, I was doing everything I could with a cigarette lighter and old patches that I'd pulled carefully off of other parts of the tube, and oh, what a nightmare. Rivets would have been great. And I think puncture has also got to be somehow related to our terms here. Because that's the problem that we're solving. You always want to, when we're doing our search terms, I think it's always beneficial to keep your terms short enough so that you'll actually turn something up, but including something about the problem, puncture, putting the word puncture in is already turning up flats, so that might be another alternative word.
Yep.
Sometimes I like to keep a little list. This might be a tip that's useful for others. I don't know if you do something like this, Christian, where I just put in kind of a little mind map of the terms that I'm using, flat, puncture.
Yep. Definitely the way to go. I think it's useful when you've got a PC if you can open lots and lots of tabs at the same time and remember not to close them indiscriminately.
The extra challenge today is that because of the lack of a power supply, Christian is doing his looking on a phone, proving that you truly could do it at the pub like we've
we have done this before. Yep. You correct me, I'm coming up with lots of tools for these things.
One of which I'm seeing on Amazon.com, there is a product called the Stop and Go 1085 Deluxe Tire Repair Kit for $52. It uses a gun, so we're already a bit different, but at least we're seeing rivets in use in tires.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it's if you look and think about a pop rivet and the way that works in terms of inserting the rivet through the hole and
pulling.
Then and pulling the and deforming the metal and then
yes.
cracking off the internal spike.
Yes.
They're using quite a big leverage on that.
Yep.
So in order to get that leverage, it might need a lever of some sort rather than a pull. But
I reckon, you know, does some of that come from the nature of the metal material? We're talking about plastic here, and deformation might take less leverage and maybe even the inclusion of some sort of adhesive for the inside so that it, you know, even only partially deforming it causes some adhesive contact to the inside?
Possibly, and how fast he can inflate the inner tube as well. It'll hold it on the outside, so that'll aid the deformation to that particular shape.
Okay. But now remember, we're not trying to invent at the moment. We're trying to find prior art or available products. One and the same. Well, not one and the same, but two sides of the same coin. Promising anyway. Okay, so we're seeing tools. Anything coming up for you, Christian?
Not at the moment, there's lots of pictures of kits for repairing punctures. So nothing's.
Driver's choice. Nope, that's the old school. Driver's choice tube repair kits, adhesive based only on the outside of the tube. That's not the one. But what's our principle? We know it's out there, right? We know it's out there. Pop rivet ice tires for your road bike. There's an interesting one. Lateral thinking here. Using pop rivets, as we've just discussed, to make ice tires. So, you know, using the rivet feature it backwards to create some more grip and traction on ice.
Yep.
So if any of you are out there thinking about taking a bike ride in snow and ice, they've used rivets from the inside out, kind of backwards, to create some hard knobs for grip.
There's all sorts of kits from AliExpress for car tires and tubeless repairs for the tire itself, mate.
Only for tubeless.
Yep.
Tubeless. So is that enough? Can they be used from the outside of the tire?
Yes.
Okay, well then, so are we onto something here? Does it really then matter that it's done on tubeless versus in a tube? Could not the same thing work in both applications?
Definitely. You're penetrating the outside layer
of something,
and you're sealing the hole.
Yep. Right. So that's okay. So part. Let's get that down. Now, what can you flick me that? Gotcha. Okay. Now that's with a tool.
It's with a tool. Yeah.
So
it's not got your integrated.
Well, but now this is an important part of the step, because it's an important part of the step, and we like to rush through this. That's part of the thrill of the chase, is trying to get through this quickly. However, looking at how they describe that gives us some more useful terms, right?
Yes.
Are you seeing in there that we might use to refine and see if we can get a better result?
I'm going to go and look in the I think I'm going to look in the patent, in the Google patents as well, just giving me a bit of a
take us along the journey.
Yeah, I think what I've done is gone back to Google patents and put in bike tire rivet puncture.
Bike tire rivet puncture.
Yeah, and just to see what comes up there. There's lots of things about, you know, bike. There are a few systems for putting a rivet in a, from the 1890s, for putting a rivet in the bike tire and then putting an adhesive around the outside. So you're going from the inside out, so you're having a top hat type of arrangement, but obviously you can't do that with your inner tube.
Right.
Just looking through the things like I might have to put a tool into here, but this is the same one here. It's called a gumming tool for mending pneumatic tires, which is more to do with the glue gun and being a hand deformable
rivet. Hey, you know, one of the best things that could possibly happen right now is that we don't find this and we actually have an anonymous tip.
We do.
As to something that might actually be an improvement on repairing bicycle tires. That would make me very happy.
And it's always good to do this, because, as we always say, if you don't find it at the first instance, then you need to keep on looking. It's not the end of the story.
No. And getting to the end of a 15-minute snap is really just a production limitation that we put on ourselves. If we don't find what we think would be a complete snap in this case, we're going to come back to this.
There's more stuff. There's a lot of stuff out there, which is the key thing. The fact that we're not finding something just means that there's a lot of material and we've only looked at a very, very small amount of it. So here's another. There's a patent here from 1898, and it's called...
What's the patent number there, Christian?
It says 612145.
US?
Yes.
One more time.
6, 1, 2, 1, 4, 5. And that's got a picture in, this, in figure two. I don't know if you come up with that.
Yep.
So that's got a rivet with a that's applied using a threaded bar. So you've got your rivet going through that, and you're squashing it around the hole in the tire. Now, again, it's probably not feasible to do that with an inner tube, but it's showing you a different mechanism. Rather than a lever, you're using a clamping force to squash the rivet around the hole in the tire.
Right. The threading is providing the leverage for the force to squish the two together.
Yes.
So this may be one of those things where the material science allows us to, the material properties allow us to do something different.
So I've just been looking through the Google patents, and the terminology search terms I typed in are bike tire rivet puncture. So I haven't included tool in that. And what you can do when you're in the Google patents search engine is you can set it to find the earliest patent. So the search results come back from the earliest date rather than the latest date.
I've not ever used that feature. Is this down on the left? I've done bike tire rivet puncture, and the date is the priority date?
Yes. So then you should go to the search tools.
Sort by relevance, sort by oldest.
Yes, that's right.
Gotcha. I've never done that. Cool.
And that's one of the key things when you're looking at these generic things,
oldest.
To find the oldest, simplest, and go through that. So we put that in there, and we've come up with this is a probably a couple of pages in. It's quite a lot of material, as we said, and we found this patent that's called Process of Repairing or Closing Punctures in Pneumatic Tires and Plug for That Purpose. So the number is US again.
Which page are you on there? How far deep did you go? Armor for Pneumatic Tires. Yep. Apparatus for Repairing Pneumatic Tires. Can you just tell us briefly how quickly you glossed over? Were you just reading titles and ignoring anything that didn't have any sort of descriptive title when it was just saying?
Yeah, well, I'm looking on the phone, so it's really difficult to see the small picture that comes alongside the list.
Yeah.
So for the things that look interesting, I've been going into that and downloading the PDF, which is pretty straightforward. And from the PDF, you can see in the older patents, all the drawings, or a lot of the drawings are on the front page. So we've been going through that, and I've just seen something that looks like something that you could apply through the ant. It's for a tire again, so it's not the inner tube, but it's a rivet that's applied, then a piece is inserted inside the rivet, and then that piece has got a fork on the end of it, and as you retract your piece, it pushes the inside of the rivet up against the inside of the outer wall of the tube, and creates the squash rivet. It looks like it's using a hand tool and those sorts of things. So just going to
what was the number of that?
So the number of the patent is US again 1456403. That's 1923.
Gotcha. There we go. Okay, I can see that now. Yep. Now that looks a lot like the description from what we've read, and it just seems that it would seem that even if that was an applicator, if our modern material science allowed us to do that as a single unit where that just broke away without a gun of any kind or a separate tool, that this might be a snap.
Yep, I think so.
Excellent. The great thing about this one is that we see that the principles behind a rivet to fix a tire are found in a very old patent from 1923, meaning we have pretty clear freedom to operate in this space of riveting tires, and that the absence of needing a tool would really just be a slight design improvement around the thickness of the materials, how to keep them in a deformed position, maybe with some sort of adhesive on the inside of them or some other way of doing that, but that we could probably make one, experiment with one of these and proceed with one of these and make a product that isn't currently in the market. We don't quickly see, at least, anything that doesn't require a gun. And if you're on a bicycle, you don't really want to be carrying anything large enough that would require that gun, which is obviously why whoever submitted this has hoped for one that was integrated as a pull tab that they could then just not chuck on the ground because we're good, tidy Kiwis, but put in their pocket and carry on.
Yeah, so the important thing here is, yes, it's been done in principle. So the broad concept's been done, which is no bad thing. We now know that. The next step would be, if we go down that road, is to understand what developments have occurred after that point in time. So one of the things that we could look at is that patent itself and looking at the forward citation. So we're looking at the patents which have cited that one.
Right.
And that may lead us to something, may lead us nowhere, but it may lead us to see that other people have implemented the same sort of process to address a similar problem.
So look at me, I was just jumping to conclusions. Yeah. I did what I'm telling everybody not to do, which is I went straight from this prior art to, hey, we could start experimenting with this applicator. See, all of us are susceptible to this.
Definitely. And there may even be products out there. The fact that we've had a look and haven't found anything immediately doesn't mean that there's nothing there. So it's going into that. And the other thing to consider, actually, is that there will be other tube repair processes that people may use. And you might look at that and say, this is a really cheap, really handy thing for a bike tire or a bike inner tube. But there may be biomedical applications for wanting to seal up a hole in a heart valve or an artery or a vein or something like that very quickly. And this, I'm not saying it could be, but this is where ideas come from. People say, actually, there are other applications, there are other problems that people have where they're trying to seal up a fluid-containing tube, a flexible tube.
Because in essence, we've just expanded our circle of competence by looking around.
Completely. And when you see what other people have done, that sparks other thoughts and other ideas and other applications and other things. And it may be that there's the application in a biomedical industry or in another application for fixing, you know, you might have a hole in your garden hose, and it's something that you could quickly and easily plug together rather than throw a whole length of the hose out and start again.
Excellent. Well, it's never a loss. When you go through this process, there's no losing whatsoever. We're just learning more. We're finding other ways to solve problems, and we're finding other applications to use the solutions that we've discovered along the way, finding other applications that they might be well suited for.
And it illustrates perfectly that you don't have to be the inventor. You don't have to be the first. There are still lots of opportunities by using other people's processes, even though you'd hoped it was yours in the first place, but now it isn't. You know that you can march forward and address that opportunity much more quickly.
Now, we stopped recording, and Christian pulled out his patent that he had cited when we were talking about the trampoline and said a remarkable thing. Can you just repeat that, Christian?
Really, just looking at similarities, Matt, there's a lot of similarities between this particular patent, which shows a trailer with some...
We're talking about the trampoline now.
The trampoline, yes.
The prior art to the trampoline.
So this was the fire escape. So this was the device for catching people jumping from burning buildings in 1883. And the structure of it is very similar, and there's a lot of functionality that's very similar to an IP snap that we did previously, which is around the boxing ring. So this thing's got a trailer, it's got a framework, and it's suspending a flexible platform above the framework on the trailer. And that's what the boxing ring did, and that's exactly what this fire escape's doing as well. So there's some connections there from things that previously we wouldn't even have connected. And in the case of this fire escape, nobody cited it ever. So we're maybe the first people to have read this patent for a long, long time, as opposed to a machine-read version, and we're the ones who've made the connection to the seemingly completely different boxing ring.
Which beautifully illustrates this idea that as we're looking around for the plastic rivet solution, that we might stumble upon the concept of applying it to a biomedical application like stopping up an artery. Here, knowing that this fire escape was applicable to a trampoline, it's also applicable to a boxing ring, which just happens to be one that we've looked at before. So we're expanding our circle of competence. We're starting to see interconnections without ever having to pick up a tool. We're standing on the shoulders of these giants to look at other ways to solve problems using stuff that has already been done. The old adage, if all you have is a hammer, all you see are nails. I would rather have the entire toolbox at my disposal. When we could think of the global stock of knowledge as that toolbox. It's an infinite toolbox, practically, for all of our purposes.
Yes, and going back to the rock, paper, scissors, an infinite number of those rocks to work with.
Well, we've certainly covered a lot of ground today, haven't we, Christian?
We have, certainly have, Matt.
This circle of competence is a really important concept. I think it has applications in so many parts of our lives, dealing with ideas that we think are going to become commercializable or social enterprises that are going to have an impact on the world, maybe even on a deeper personal level about what you do with your day, even if you don't have any hope of making a return on it. Although you should treat every minute of every day as something that you're investing in yourself. So maybe this has philosophical applications to how we live our lives.
It completely has. And the other thing is it's actually a really refreshing process to go through, because people say, you know, you need to learn something new every day. And in doing this work, you're learning something every day. And that contributes to your knowledge. It also contributes to your ideas process, because quite often things that you see trigger new ideas.
Yeah.
And so it's a great way of exercising yourself. And the other thing to realize as well, that we're not putting this into a silo of technology or silo of market research or anything else. The whole stock of knowledge, circle of competence, interchangeably covers off all of those things. So it's not just about somebody did this invention in a particular year. It's about somebody bought this company, and actually there's a person here who used to work for somebody else, and now he works for this company. This is what he's done. These are the papers they've published. This is the lawsuits that company's been through now and historically. And just understanding the direction of technology, direction of inventions, where things have gone, what steps have been taken, and when things have been cut short, because there's always a decision process that, if you look back to a decision tree, if you like, somebody took a decision back in 1920 or earlier than that, that they were going to go down the road of using petrol-powered vehicles and not based on corn oil and not on electricity. So you can go back to those points in time and think, well, actually, if I was in that position to make those decisions now, what would we take? And that can create a whole lot of new ideas as well. So it's a very informative process. It's certainly for me, and I know for other people, it's an enjoyable process to learn these new things.
And it's free.
And it's free.
And it's so much less painful than peeing on an electric fence.
It certainly is. And it doesn't matter where you are or who you are or anything else, you can do this work from anywhere in the world and create the same level of competency, no matter what your background or interests are.
And no matter whether you have no ideas, right? I mean, that we found a new way to get involved, which is just look for problems and we'll see if we can find the ideas together. Or if you have one idea, and in which case that's a very dangerous position to be in until you know that it's okay not to act on things, because it's better to not act than to act in an uninformed way and stumble around in the dark and hurt yourself.
Yes, we talked obviously today about that, the statistics of the golden shot. There will always be people who become successful because they were very lucky and it was the right time and these sorts of things. And again, we need to be following not the successes, but actually understanding the failures. And understanding the failures gives a lot more information than attempting to understand why something succeeded or somebody succeeded.
What we want to talk about next, it seems that we're naturally heading towards talking about startups. And before we even talk about that, I think we're going to need to get real pedantic like we've been doing, define terms really clearly. One of the things we'll start off with is talking about this phrase, business in the idea phase. Let's stop saying business in the idea phase. It immediately presumes that there's a business there or an opportunity there when we don't have any proof of that. So we'll jump into that. We'll be really clear about the correct timing and process and steps from ideation to startup, so that there's no blurriness between the two, no blurred lines. We recently saw, Christian, you found this article about quick startups in under an hour sort of thing, which is, it sounds very exciting, and it's great as long as it's step two, right? I mean,
yes. I mean, effectively, by saying you can do that in half an hour or an hour, means that you're going from the spark of the idea to creating a business in the space of half an hour, and you're never, ever going to have your circle of competence or the knowledge of the global stock of knowledge in that time frame.
So as long as it's step two, right? This is the real differentiation. We'd love to see that businesses are getting so quick at pulling together teams, funding. That's a huge, important part of a good ecosystem, a good innovation ecosystem. But it's got to be step two, yeah?
It has. And the other thing as well is that really, if you're looking at starting up something in 25 minutes, you're probably going into that startup with one idea and trying to encourage other people within that group to join you in that one idea. So it's not really statistically, again, if you've only got one idea, then it's very hard to have that golden shot, and it would make a lot more sense to have lots of ideas, or six ideas, for example, five or six ideas, and to go through all of those ideas before you choose even which one to go with.
If you've only got one thing between inaction and that one idea, because we have the patience and we have the discipline not to just act to be seen to be acting, is that what a savvy investor is? To have the patience to not put the money on the table.
Completely. And that, again, is about understanding the fundamentals. It's about having a process. So if you've got one idea, then it's likely that there'll be the leader of that idea, probably the originator, and like the Pied Piper, they'll be piping away, hoping that other people join in that over a very short period of time, so everyone's a believer. And unfortunately, it comes back to that reliance on somebody else doing the homework. So the people who are following are likely to think, oh, actually, this person's done a bit of thinking about this. They've got that knowledge. They don't independently go through it. They don't have a process to check it, but we'll go along with that because it sounds like a good thing.
And if you start up without a pre-flight check, you're just a joyrider, yeah? You're just hooning, and you're likely to have an accident.
Completely. Well, you're not going to get where you want to go.
So tune in next time as we together expand our circle of competence to include startups and all the culture and attitudes around them. As always, I want to thank my good friend Christian.
And thanks to you as well, Matt.
And thank all of you for listening. See you next time.
See ya.